We'll take just a minute or two for Dr. Crawford to respond to the respondents. It'll be very brief, and then we'll open the floor to questions.
Yeah, so just very briefly in response to Fred Turner. So what I presented is on his account is can be understood as a literary exercise, expression of atavistic tribal fury, fairly typical of America as revealed by January 6th, a sort of right-wing version of the purification fetish of the woke revolution, kind of like Agamemnon's paranoia, getting ready for a little human sacrifice, sacrificial scapegoating. I'll take that as literary in the spirit offered as somewhat fanciful. On the more substantive bit about masks and science, I think the career of the lab leak hypothesis gives us a kind of glimpse into the actual practice of science. One's recalled to Thomas Kuhn, structure of scientific revolutions. There's a whole sociology of science. Something like a conspiracy of evidence tampering seems indeed to have been the case there. And as for masks, sort of nowhere in the sort of public accounting of the of masks is the sort of the damage to the social fabric, and in particular for sort of childhood development. So I understand, if you're over 80, you might have a maximalist view of mask wearing, but for kids running around a soccer field, there is a real cost, and it's sort of off the books of the technocratic accounting, I think, because you have to have a bit of a humanistic view of what's at stake, and being able to see people's faces. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
First question.
Good morning. Preston Knoll, Tradition, Family, and Property. So I have a kind of a simple question. I have a friend who for 20 years worked in IT at Northwestern University, and among his other duties, he is a professional photographer who was enlisted to photograph and document the surgeries that were done there. And he said that for the last 20 years, all of the N95 masks came in a box that said this is not protection against, is not protective against viruses. And he said that if the patient had a cough or a cold, they wouldn't operate because they might infect the doctors. So what happened from 20 years of that experience in the last year and a half, well, all of a sudden we're safe if we put on these face diapers. I'm just wondering, what did I miss?
Preston, would you direct that question to any particular member of the panel, or is it an open question?
I think maybe Mr. Turner would be the person who ought to hear the question.
Okay.
As I said in my talk, I'm not an epidemiologist. I can only go on the authorities that all seem to stress that there is a distinct and significant statistical effect of masking in terms of limiting the spread of the disease. It's not totally effective from what they say, but it is better than nothing. So if there are people who know better than I, then I can entirely concede that point. What I don't necessarily agree with is that the imposition of these rules is an attempt to reduce the population of the United States to a slave state. I think that's a little bit of an overreach.
Joseph?
Joe Sullivan. I'm a business and financial consultant. I would like Fred, in particular you, but also everyone on the panel, to address two related phenomena that we didn't expressly talk about, but came close. One is the embedding in virtually every significant institution, whether business or nonprofit, in America, people who are called diversity and inclusion officers, but in fact are political officers according to the old standard. Now, these people have to have something to do. Now, there is a related phenomenon, which is more rhetorical, Fred, but that is the use of terms like denier and hater, and the formation of lists of people who deny or hate. Now, these terms are greatly extended over anything we would have understood, especially hate, which used to consider a very, very powerful, dangerous emotion, but now is anyone who is anti-progressive. The lists that have been formed of these, everyone is aware of Southern Poverty, which is truly a malignant list and is used by business institutions all over. There's at least one more, and by the way, I didn't read about this, I know about this, I'm working with this stuff, which is being used by financial institutions and also by many of the supposedly independent tech providers to deplatform and deny people everything, including credit card processing and the right to have bank accounts. Now, we have these two phenomena going. In view of that, Fred, you in particular, perhaps it's not paranoia? And would the other two, you know, discuss your views of these phenomena and how they relate to your discussion?
Well, can I?
Good, Fred.
I agree entirely that a large part of the higher education system bought into critical theory, critical race theory. I recommend Pluckrose and Lindsay's wonderful book, Cynical Theories, excellent book, which sort of gives the whole history of it. I've seen it myself, and I've fought it in the university, in the institutions that I've been in. And in my institution, UTD, we have a School of Arts and Humanities that is fairly well balanced in terms of its political, social, cultural attitudes, and I take some credit for that. So I'm a warrior in this one. I think it's probably going to be a passing thing. I think that we will be developing institutions, and I'm working with various groups, educational groups myself, to create alternative kinds of humanities teaching, or institutions and that kind of thing, that will sort of bypass and compete against the woke universities. And my suggestion is that the woke wokery, which is explicitly claims that that one's self-identification, for instance, is just socially constructed. In other words, it eschews actual evidence. You know, ought to be designated as a religion. And in that case, it should be given all the freedom of religion and also the withdrawal of all state funds, since the Constitution states that there will be no establishment of religion. So that would be one of my ways of trying to deal with that. I just think that, you know, mask requirements don't really have very much to do with that particular form of sickness in the academy. I've seen lots of times of sickness in the academy, and this is just another one, I think.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think one can draw a kind of, I was going to say a formal parallel, but not merely formal, between health emergency, COVID, and the moral emergency of white supremacism. In both cases, the emergency provides the indispensable predicate or the expansion of administrative authority, just as 9/11 did with the emergency of jihad. So it's not that these threats are non-existent, but they become, again, the predicate for power. So there's a parallel.
Jacob, did you have one?
Why don't we have another question?
John?
Yeah.
Let me lower this mic since life's too short and so am I. John Zmarek, I write for The Stream. I would like to propose to all the speakers that maybe the focus of the confluence of tyranny and COVID should be less on masks and more on the vaccine. Last week, I called my sister to try to visit her. I live in Texas, but I'm from New York. I wanted to visit my sister for Christmas. She informed me she'd love to see me, but in a public place, but I can't stay at her house because I'm not vaccinated. And she is. Is that how vaccines work? Where you have the vaccine, so you're protected, and the people who don't have the vaccine are a threat to you because... how? My sister is a nurse, okay? And like me, she's pro-life. I won't take the vaccine. And I'm in a risk group because I'm fat, and I might die of this thing. I don't want to benefit from abortion. And every single one of the vaccines was either developed or tested using aborted babies. And I'm sorry, we're talking about evidence. And Professor Turner, I loved your book, The Culture of Hope. I've read your epic poem. I've benefited from your intellect. I would like you to take seriously what I'm saying, because I think your invocation of Greek myth and the ancient polis is appropriate, but I think you need to apply it differently. The unvaccinated,
John,
are the scapegoat.
Less talk and revert to the opening question, please.
Okay, fine.
This is our last question.
I'm sorry.
Needs to end very quickly.
All right.
So,
Mr. Crawford, maybe you might want to consider the vaccine question. I would like a response from both of you about the issue of scapegoating the unvaccinated and whether the human sacrifice that this plague is requiring is of unborn babies.
On the last point, I'm not familiar with the unborn baby vaccine connection. But as far as you're right, there's a kind of the demand for vaccination isn't simply coming from the government. Our relatives and such make these demands upon us. I think that's partly a function of the extreme scaremongering they've been subjected to. Scaremongering is the fundamental business model of mass media. And of course, there's synergies with bureaucratic power there. So when we say, public demand for the vaccine, also, there's been quite a bit of propagandizing on behalf of it. And you don't it doesn't require a vast conspiracy. You just have to look at the interests of the people who are communicating about the pandemic. I mean, there's a kind of emergent property here that looks like a conspiracy, but you don't have to posit actual collusion. That's all.
Fred, very brief.
Just very briefly. Yes, I think that there is a on the left. There definitely is a movement to scapegoat people who resist vaccination and people who resist mask wearing. Paranoia feeds on paranoia. The scapegoating is rather nicely balanced on both sides, and is in a sense damaging what is good about liberalism and damaging what is good about conservatism. It's
all right.
Pitiful thing.
Well, thank you. Join me in thanking the panelists. Thank you, Fred, Matt, Jacob. That concludes this session. Thank you.